Welcome to American Indian Living, a program developed by the Native Education and Health Initiative to improve and enhance the health of people throughout the Native communities. American Indian Living is hosted by Dr. David DeRose, a board-certified specialist in both internal medicine and preventive medicine. Dr. DeRose has a wide range of experience with Native health issues, and he's ready today to help you learn more about your health. Here's Dr. DeRose.
Welcome to American Indian Living. I'm Dr. David DeRose. Today we've got an exciting show lined up for you. It's a bit different because the main expert on the show is actually your host. With me, though, in the studio is my wife, Dr. Sonia DeRose. Sonia, it's great to have you with us.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Sonia, you know that recently, actually just last week, I was in Atlanta, Georgia, at the National Congress of American Indians. And leading up to that, we had some interesting conversations with Native American leaders, didn't we?
Yes, we did.
Well, you know, the thing that really struck me in those preliminary discussions was the desire that there was, with the venue being in Atlanta, to talk about the subject of Ebola and to see if we could get the Centers for Disease Control to join us while we were there in Atlanta. Sonia, you've been looking at the news like everyone else, and Ebola has been in the headlines. It's from a public health standpoint, how would you characterize it?
It's not a small issue. And it could well get worse before it gets better.
Yeah, I think that's the fear that everyone has. And so when that Native American leader talked with me, and when I reached out to the Centers for Disease Control, we were looking to try to do a special program focused on Ebola. We actually did get some great cooperation from the CDC, and we've got a great show lined up that you'll be hearing in the future. But it actually was not on Ebola. It was actually more on topics that relate to some very exciting things happening in Indian country. So I was left with this challenge, Sonia. We have interest in Indian country about Ebola. Things weren't coming together for the show, so you kind of know what played out, right?
Yes, it turned out to be very interesting, and you came out with a new book.
Yeah, that's right. I took the challenge on myself. I've been working on topics, those of you tuning in today who don't know me, I've been working on topics that relate to infectious diseases and preventive medicine for decades. And so when the interest came out with Ebola, we said we've got to get to the literature ourselves, pull some things together so we can give some clear messaging both on the radio show and, hey, put it in print. So we did roll something out very recently. Sonia, what is the resource that's now available?
It's a new book entitled Evading Ebola, Decrease Your Risk of Infection, Fare Far Better If Exposed.
That's right. So that's the book I pulled together, and it initially rolled out on Kindle. By the time this show airs, it should be also available on Amazon and in other settings. The goal today is really to give you the information from that book without you having to rush off to the Kindle store or to Amazon and get those materials, to try to give you practical information that can make a difference as far as you dealing with this modern scourge. As we're really looking at the topic, Sonia, you and I have been dealing with health professionals. We were just in Southern California. I actually gave a talk on Ebola there. There were a number of physicians there, and a lot of them are asking the same kind of questions that people in the public are asking. What kind of things did you hear people asking, or do you hear as you just listen to the news?
Well, there's three questions that I'm sure have come to many people's minds. One is, what happens if I'm exposed? How can I decrease my risk? And what should our country and our communities be doing about this?
Yeah, you're exactly right, Sonia. I mean, there's these issues that are global, you know, the public health issues, but there's also the very personal issues and health professionals being on the front lines. And we've already seen it in this country, haven't we, with health professionals actually coming in harm's way.
Definitely.
Well, Sonia, I'll throw this out. You've heard me talk about it before. I've given a couple of public presentations now on Ebola. We just gave one in Northern California, which, if you're just tuning in for the first time, is where we're actually based. Was presenting to a group of about 100 people just the other night. I gave this analogy, and I want your feedback, Sonia. Tell me if you think this works, because I don't think we've actually sat down and you just told me straight whether this analogy fits. Here's how I've presented it. I see many Americans behaving as if Ebola is some type of rogue enemy army, that this foreign invader has come onto our shores, that we as individuals have no recourse but to look to the federal government to save us. It's up to the military, the Centers for Disease Control, the National Institutes of Health. But when it comes to us individually, we are just basically at the whims of Ebola. If the government doesn't take care of this problem for us, if it gets out in the community, we're just in terrible trouble. I don't know, Sonia, do you think that analogy is valid, or do you think I'm stretching things too much?
Well, I think that could be the public opinion, that is a valid illustration for the public opinion today, but that isn't the case. There is a lot that we can do about it.
Of course, and you're exactly right, because that's what the whole purpose of the book Evading Ebola is all about. It's about the fact that we actually can do something about Ebola, even if it comes knocking at our doors, so to speak. That's what we want to talk about, isn't it?
Yes.
Well, Sonia, to get some background and bring our listeners up to speed, we've got to tell them about something you and I learned in medical school called inapparent infections.
That's right. Inapparent infections occur all the time. Many of you have had them and never were even aware of it.
That's exactly right. I mean, that's what an inapparent infection is, because let's talk about the flu, influenza. If someone gets an inapparent infection, Sonia, they get infected with the virus, right?
Yes.
And then what happens?
They either never know that they were even infected with it, or maybe they feel a little tired one day or something, but their immune system is strong enough that they fight it off without ever really becoming sick.
Exactly. And this is a huge issue in the healthcare community. For what reason? Vaccines, right?
Yes, vaccines.
Yeah, they're right there. They're on the front lines of vaccines, and health professionals, if they haven't been vaccinated, they're being told by the hospitals that they need to get a shot. And many of them say, "Well, I never get the flu." What's the problem with that argument?
The problem is that they may never get it themselves, but they can still be exposed to the virus, carry it, fight it off themselves. But while they're fighting it off, they could expose another patient who has a lowered immune system to it, and that person could get the flu from them, even though they never even knew they had the virus.
This exactly is it, Sonia. I mean, it's a huge problem with inapparent infections, because the concern is you can have the infection, you can be a carrier, if you will, and you can spread it to other people, including susceptible, say, intensive care unit patients, seriously ill people in the emergency room. And so during flu season, every health professional in every hospital I know of is saying, you either have to get a flu shot or you've got to wear a mask the whole
time
during flu season, because we're not going to allow our patients to be exposed to an unvaccinated person who could transmit the virus, right?
That's right.
Let's talk about another example, because I think this is perhaps even more poignant. Sonia, I know a lot of people in Indian country relate to you because you're a person who has a particular affinity for a certain animal. Do you want to tell us a little bit about what one of your hobbies has been for many years?
Yes, I enjoy horses. I love horses. I love horseback riding. I've had a horse for years. And they're just a very special animal.
So we want to talk about an interesting aspect of inapparent infections. If you're listening, you'll see where we're going with this. Very interesting aspect. Horses are known to be at risk of a transmissible disease. It's a viral disease transmitted by mosquitoes. Sonia, you know what we're talking about, right?
Yes, Eastern equine encephalitis.
And of course, there's a Western variety as well.
There's also a Western variety.
But we want to illustrate it with Eastern equine encephalitis. Now, we're not trying to play with the letter E, just because I've got a book, Evading Ebola, and now Eastern equine encephalitis. I didn't even think about that before the show, Sonia, but we've got a lot of E's here. Anyway, Eastern equine encephalitis can not only affect horses, but it can affect people. Sonia, give us just some of the fundamentals of what this looks like if it affects a human being.
Yes, this disease can be potentially very devastating. It's a viral illness. As my husband mentioned, it's transmitted by mosquitoes. Most cases occur in the Atlantic and Gulf Coast states. And those infected can develop encephalitis with headache, high fever, chills, and vomiting.
So now encephalitis, break that down for us. People have heard of it, but they may not know what it is.
Yes, that's an infection or inflammation of the brain.
Okay, so this virus, this Eastern equine encephalitis virus, can affect horses, but it can affect people. You say it can be really bad, causing headaches, fever, chills, vomiting. I mean, that sounds bad, but I mean, can it cause anything worse?
Definitely. It can progress on to cause disorientation, seizures, coma, and even death.
Wow.
In fact, yeah. About 33%, you get about 33% mortality with significant brain damage in most survivors. So even if you survive, there can be a lot of problems.
Okay, I mean, now this, if you listen to this, Eastern equine encephalitis, this viral disease, I mean, it sounds a lot like Ebola. I'm not saying they're equivalent, but I mean, many of the symptoms are the same, right? You know, vomiting, high fever, chills, coma, death. Now, granted, the mortality in this current Ebola outbreak, at least in West Africa, around 70%, much better here in the States. We'll perhaps talk about that some as we go through the show. But 33% mortality here in the U.S., if I get Eastern equine encephalitis, is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
And if I'm one of the two-thirds that survive, the prognosis isn't all that good for long-term health.
No, you can still have significant brain damage even if you survive, and that's not a pretty picture.
Well, then it sounds, Sonia, like maybe we should be more afraid of Eastern equine encephalitis. I mean, why isn't this just ravaging America?
Well, most people that are infected with it have no apparent illness. In fact, there's only a few clinical cases that are reported in the U.S. each year.
Isn't that amazing? What you're telling us is that when we speak about this killer disease, it's in our midst all the time, Eastern equine encephalitis. Most people haven't even heard of it because the average person, if they get bitten by a mosquito with it, their body just fights it off. They never get sick, right?
Yes. Which is a good thing.
Yeah, definitely. So we're talking about viral illnesses. Many of them can cause inapparent infection. That's true with the flu. It's true with Eastern equine encephalitis. It's true with mono, isn't it? With polio before the vaccine, right?
Yes, I was just going to bring that up. Before polio vaccine came out, there were thousands upon thousands of people who were exposed and had the polio virus, but fought it off and never came down with clinical polio.
Well, this begs a million-dollar question. Nobody's talking about inapparent infection. I haven't heard anybody beside myself speaking about it. What about Ebola? Is there any evidence that inapparent infection can make a difference? Sonia, I know you've looked at some of this research literature with me, and both of us have been captivated by a case series study that came out of Gabon, Africa in 1996. Tell us what was happening there back nearly two decades ago.
Yes, well, there was an outbreak of Ebola in Zaire, and it had a 70% case fatality rate then. But these Gabonese researchers made a remarkable discovery.
Yeah, and of course, Ebola Zaire is the name of the virus because there's five types of Ebola. We'll talk about that some more. So this outbreak, Sonia, you're exactly right. I mean, it traces back to this virus that originally was identified in Zaire, but this is in Gabon, Africa, 1996. And the researchers actually did something I thought was amazing. Tell our listeners what these folks found after the outbreak. What did they identify?
They identified 24 close contacts of Ebola patients, and each of these contacts had been directly exposed to infected materials, either feces, vomit, saliva, sweat, or blood.
Okay, this is a high-risk situation. The bottom line, though, is what, honey?
Not one of the 24 ever became ill.
Not one of the 24 became ill. these folks had inapparent infection. We're going to tell you more about that amazing study and what it means for you, how you can be exposed to Ebola. Even if it gets a foothold here in the U.S., you do not need to get sick. That's the message of my book, Evading Ebola. It's the message of this program. Don't go away. I'm Dr. David DeRose. We've got a lot more to come. Life-changing secrets on Ebola. Stay tuned.
Today's broadcast has been pre-recorded. However, if you have questions about today's show or would like further information, please call 1-800-775-HOPE. That's 1-800-775-4673. We'll be right back after this.
Navigating this world when you are undereducated can be difficult. I'm Dr. Ben Carson, and I know this for a fact. When I was growing up, my family lived in dire poverty, and because of my poor learning skills, my classmates called me dummy. My life began to turn around when my mother encouraged me to read. I went from the bottom of my class to graduating from Yale University and becoming the youngest director of pediatric neurosurgery at Johns Hopkins Hospital. I know how important it is to nurture a child's dream.
When I grow up, I want to become a scientist.
I want to be a doctor, just like Ben Carson.
I hope to become an engineer.
I want to be a teacher or maybe a broadcaster.
The Carson Scholars Fund is impacting schools across the nation by encouraging children to read, write, and excel at math and science so they can realize their dreams. We need your help. To learn more about the Carson Scholars Fund and to donate, visit our website at carsonscholars.org.
After all, the person who has the most to do with your success is you.
This is the story of Daniel, who was born 2 months early. He weighed 1 pound, 7 ounces. His lungs weren't ready. His heart wasn't ready. His brain wasn't ready. At the hospital, the nurses said Daniel was a fighter, and they would do all they could to help him. The doctor said even with the best care, Daniel may never walk. He may never see. He may never learn. Daniel's parents spent night after night at the hospital, watching his every breath, holding his tiny hands, and looking for signs that he was growing stronger. At home, his parents looked around Daniel's empty nursery, at the quiet toys and the still rocker, and they hoped that one day they could sit in that rocking chair and tell this story to their very healthy son. Daniel's is just one of the more than 500,000 stories of babies born prematurely last year, but there's hope for a happy ending. The March of Dimes is funding the research and programs to stop premature birth. You can help bring more babies home healthy. Learn how at marchofdimes.com. Working together for stronger, healthier babies.
You're listening to Dr. David DeRose on American Indian Living. Your comments and questions are welcome. Call now at 1-800-775-HOPE. 1-800-775-4673. Here again is Dr. DeRose.
You're back with Dr. David DeRose, the radio show American Indian Living. My guest, Sonia DeRose. Dr. Sonia DeRose, also a physician. Sonia, a family practice physician by training. She's spending a lot of time running our business, Compass Health Consulting. That's one of the partners in American Indian Living Radio, and it is the publisher of our new book called Evading Ebola. Let's just give a quick recap as we're coming back into the segment. We're looking at an amazing study out of Gabon, Africa, 1996. Quickly bring us up to speed, Sonia.
Okay. There was this outbreak with the Ebola Zaire virus in Gabon, Africa, and they identified 24 close contacts of Ebola patients.
Now, and you mentioned before, these close contacts just doesn't mean they're in the same household. These are individuals who had the very kind of exposures that everyone is so deathly afraid of today. Now, remember, these individuals had what kind of exposures? What did they document in this paper?
They were directly exposed to either feces, vomit, saliva, sweat, or blood, which all carry the virus.
Okay, and then what's the bottom line, though, that we had talked about before the break?
Not one of these 24 ever became ill.
Now, this is remarkable because the average person is thinking, boy, if I'm on a train, if I'm on a bus, if I'm on a plane, if I'm at home, if I'm in any situation, tribal council meeting, whatever it is, and someone's got Ebola and they vomit and I'm exposed to it, wow, I'm dead. I mean, we're getting some hope because everyone who's acquired Ebola here in the U.S. has survived so far. But, I mean, it's a scary business, isn't it?
Yes.
What's exciting to me, though, those 24 individuals who didn't get sick, they did something that I think is especially remarkable. They actually checked their blood for evidence of having been infected with the virus. What happened when they did that?
Yes, they showed that 11 of these 24 had been infected with the Ebola virus, yet they never became sick.
So what would we call that then?
That is an inapparent infection.
Now, isn't this exciting? So you can get the Ebola virus, you can become infected with it and not get sick. It's nearly half of the group that they studied.
That's right.
These were all close contacts. And then what about, let's make it real practical. I don't want to get too far ahead of us. We see some lessons, some good news in this scenario, in this study published back nearly 20 years ago. Good news that nobody's talking about. I haven't heard it. How would you summarize that?
Yes, well, for starters, you can be in close proximity to Ebola with no protective gear, be exposed to infective secretions, and never become infected, just as the 13 of the 24 in that study that we just cited were.
Yeah, and I think that's incredibly remarkable, and I think it's incredible good news, because a lot of people out there are just so deathly afraid of some very small, inapparent even, contact with Ebola. And the message here is you can be exposed to this virus, even though it's devastating in many cases if you get the clinical illness. Many people, even there in West Africa, get the virus. They never get sick. Their body develops an immune response. And we could draw a blood test on these people and say, 100% certainty, you have had Ebola infection. They say, hey, I never had it. I never got sick. That's right, inapparent infection.
That's right.
You've got another take-home point that we talk about in the book. What is it, Sonia?
That's right. Even if the Ebola virus does get a foothold in your body, you have the potential to fight it off without ever becoming sick.
That is exciting. That's exciting. So two encouraging messages. You can be exposed to infected secretions and not get the virus, not even get infected with it. If you do get infected, you can fight it off, just like nearly half of those folks in that study. The researchers who published this, by the way, in the journal Lancet, remember the outbreak was in 96, but you know, when you do medical research, and I've published things in the research literature, it's a process. I mean, you got to do all this legwork, you got to write the paper up, you've got to send it to a journal. I've never had a journal just look at it and say it was perfect. You know, they send it out to reviewers, they send it back for things that they want addressed, maybe they have questions and things, and then it finally gets published. So this was actually published in the year 2000, and one of the most prestigious medical journals in the world, the British journal called The Lancet. What did the researchers conclude based on these individuals who did not come down with clinical Ebola infection? In other words, they didn't show the signs or the symptoms, but we know they were infected.
Yes, I'm going to read the quote because I think it's very important. They stated, "We have found that immunological events very early in an Ebola virus infection determine the control of viral replication and recovery or catastrophic illness and death."
So how would you put that in your own words? I mean, you're a physician, you can read the medical literature, and it just makes complete sense.
So what I hear it saying is that if you have a strong immune system, what's happening early on when you're infected is going to determine whether or not you will fight it off and never know you got sick, or whether you get really sick and die with it.
No, I mean, that's exactly right. I couldn't have summarized it better, Sonia. So you hear the message. I hope it's coming through clearly to you. And that is, Ebola is not a death sentence. Being exposed to it is not, even if you don't have protective gear on. Even if you become clinically infected, you do not have to, if you become actually infected, you don't have to become clinically ill. You don't have to have the vomiting, the fever, and all the problems that can go along with full-blown Ebola infection. With that background, we are actually in this show, as we do in my book, Evading Ebola. We are going to walk you through the things that you can do to improve your immune system. Before we do, Sonia, I find a lot of people are confused about Ebola. We want to give a brief history of the virus. But even before going there, I think a lot of people, you know, as we talk with people about the new book that's out, as we mentioned, released on Amazon's Kindle as an ebook initially, What kind of response have you heard from the book, you know, at this point? What do you hear people saying? You know, how's it doing, you know, as far as, you know, sales, things of that nature?
People that I've spoken with seem to be very excited about it. They're happy to hear that there is hope that you can be exposed and not get sick. And I think it's bringing hope where it's needed.
Yeah, and we've been encouraged because the book, I mean, is pretty consistently ranking in, you know, the top 20 or 25 and in its category, which are, you know, shorter books dealing with health, fitness, and diet. So that's been exciting to see people getting the message, picking up the book, and actually applying this information. So the purpose of the show, again, is to give you the information without having to go to the Kindle store. Of course, if you want it in writing, I mean, it's there, available, and the book is coming out in hard print shortly. Let's go now to that brief history of the Ebola virus. Tell us, first of all, Sonia, real basics, what is a virus? I mean, I think a lot of people don't know the difference between a virus, a bacteria, fungi.
Yeah, simply put, a virus is a packet of infectious genetic material, either RNA or DNA, which and they lack the ability to replicate without a living host.
So in other words, viruses are not going to be multiplying on the surface of your desk.
That's correct.
Okay.
Unlike bacteria, which can replicate in different substances, spoiling food or a dead animal or whatever. But viruses have to be in a living host to reproduce themselves.
And so how does that actually work? What does a virus do that allows itself to reproduce?
Well, once a virus infects an organism, it can insert its DNA or RNA into the host cells and then orchestrate a mass production process that replicates itself. So it essentially comes and takes over your body and makes your body work for it to do what it wants it to do.
Wow, so it's kind of like hijacking.
That's right.
Your system, and it's taking your machinery that would normally make healthy proteins and antibodies and things, and now it's got it reproducing itself.
That's right.
Nasty stuff, those viruses, aren't they?
They sure are.
Well, tell us about Ebola now. Ebola, how long have we known about this virus?
It was first identified in 1976 in the context of an outbreak affecting over 300 people in northern Zaire in Africa.
Okay, so this is the so-called Ebola Zaire. It's a species or a type of Ebola. Dates back 76. We're talking, nearly 40 years, huh?
Yep, almost.
And why do they call it Ebola?
Because it first occurred in the vicinity of the Ebola River.
Okay.
And that's where the name comes from.
So we've got this Ebola virus tracing back to Africa near the Ebola River. I think the story is fascinating about actually the history of that particular initial event. And maybe we should just talk about it a little bit. This particular outbreak in northern Zaire was traced to a single individual who apparently had contracted, best I've been able to piece this, together the story, had contracted it from animals that were infected. He was in a rodent and bat-infested factory. He was the index or source patient. So that's the first case. We may speak a little bit more about that. A little bit more about the virus. Sonia, it's a member of a category called the Filoviridae in Latin. Why is Ebola and the related Marburg virus in that family?
The family name is derived from the fact that when you look at these virus under a microscope, they seem to look like strand-like filaments.
Okay, we've got a lot more about Ebola. We're going to give you more about knowing the enemy and then what you can do about it. That's coming up in our next segment. The program is called Evading Ebola. That's the same name as my book, new book, Evading Ebola. We've got more practical instruction coming right up. Don't go away.
American Indian Living will continue in a moment. If you have questions or comments about today's pre-recorded broadcast, please call 1-800-775-HOPE. That's 1-800-775-4673.
When I have an asthma attack, I feel scared. It's kind of like an elephant is on my chest.
I feel like I'm choking.
Sometimes my parents have to take me to the hospital.
You know how to react to their asthma attacks. Here's how to prevent them. Visit www.noattacks.org or call your doctor. Because even one attack is one too many.
I feel like a fish with no water.
Brought to you by the EPA and the Ad Council.
Did you know 26 million Americans have kidney disease and most don't know it?
The day I was diagnosed, I didn't know what to do. I called the National Kidney Foundation, and the young lady who answered stayed on the phone with me and walked me through step by step. She, too, was surviving kidney disease, and she showed me there could be life after kidney disease.
Visit the National Kidney Foundation at kidney.org. Now you know.
You're listening to Dr. David DeRose on American Indian Living. Your comments and questions are welcome. Call now at 1-800-775-HOPE. 1-800-775-4673. Here again is Dr. DeRose.
Welcome back to our show featuring Ebola. It's a hot topic, and it needs to be, because the evidence suggests that until that epidemic in West Africa is quelled, it is likely to be knocking again on the doors of Americans like you and me. Whether it comes to Indian country or not, it's anyone's guess, but people throughout Indian country are asking questions. That's why we're featuring it on the show. That's why I wrote the book, Evading Ebola. If you just joined us, it was a tribal leader. A tribal leader talked with me and said they really wanted a program on Ebola, and since we were having some challenges getting other experts to speak on it, I've went back to my internal medicine and preventive medicine background. I've worked some with public health departments in the past in the area of infectious disease and infectious disease outbreaks. I'm not saying I have extensive experience, but I do have a background, and dug into the medical research literature and found some very encouraging things. Sonia, my wife, is with me, Dr. Sonia DeRose. We've been speaking about some basics about Ebola. I don't think we need to really spend a lot more time about it. It's not the most important thing to realize that there's, you know, four other types of Ebola beside the Ebola Zaire that's currently affecting the world. But the point is, the current Ebola Zaire is recognized as the most deadly of the Ebola family, if you will. So with that in mind, let's talk a little bit more now about the virus, how we get it, what kind of problems it can cause. Reservoir, what does that term mean when it comes to viral illness, Sonia?
It's where the virus is can be found or is contained, how it can be spread.
Yeah, the point is, like we mentioned earlier, if you're just joining us, viral illnesses, they require a living host. So viruses don't just float around in the air for years and years and then jump on their prey. They have to have a living host. If the virus kills all the hosts, it actually very well may die out. So you've got to have some animals, in this case, that are somewhat resistant to the Ebola. What do most scientists from your reading seem to think the most likely candidate for a reservoir is?
Bats seem to be a reservoir for Ebola.
Yeah, that's the best guess, that it's bats. And there's some very interesting reports on this. Sonia, I don't know if you saw that particular article a while back where they actually, some spelunkers, some folks exploring caves, one of them, as I recall the report, actually contracted clinical Ebola. The other just developed an infection that they fought off. They had a so-called inapparent infection. But their only source that they could pin down was being in this bat-infested cave. Let's go back now to what Ebola looks like. If someone does develop a clinical infection, why are we so concerned about it in the public health community?
Well, it can be spread, obviously, very easily from the blood, feces, vomit, other bodily secretions of those who are ill with Ebola. And even sweat can carry it. So handling those dying from Ebola is very risky as far as getting the infection as well.
Yeah, and most people who've read about this, they realize that one of the big issues in West Africa are the burial practices there and the very intimate contact that people in that culture have with those who have passed away. And this seems to be one of the things that is perpetuating the virus, because the bodies of those who've died from Ebola, they are loaded with the virus.
That's right.
So even though the person is dead, the virus is still still living for a period of time. If someone is exposed to any virus, there's a period of time between exposure and developing clinical illness. What do we call
that?
That's
right. That's called the incubation period.
Okay.
And in Ebola, it ranges from 2 to 21 days. But the average incubation period seems to be between 8 and 10 days.
Now, some no doubt have been seeing that there are some reports suggesting that the incubation period may be longer than that in some cases. It's definitely an unlikely scenario, but when we say unlikely, you know, we're not talking, 0.1%. It's probably, some reports suggest it may be as much as, 10% of people may have a longer incubation. You know, of course, there's always questions, because any study only looks at usually a small group of people, especially with a virus like Ebola. But here's the point. It's simply this. If you've been exposed to Ebola, although we're using a standard quarantine period of 21 days and then signing you off, you still need to be vigilant, don't you?
That's right.
Probably for at least a week after that.
That would be playing it safe, I think, too.
Now, one of the big issues, Sonia, that I'm sure our listeners are concerned about, because everywhere I go, people are wondering about infectivity. Most public health officials are trying to quell fears that someone with undiagnosed infection can transmit the disease. Big emphasis on the idea that people have to be clinically infected in order to transmit it here. We've got a graph that's drawn from one of the descriptions in our book, Evading Ebola. And probably rather than flashing this up on the radio waves, of course I'm speaking tongue-in-cheek, let me just tell you, folks, I'll walk you through the graph. What I've got here is a graph showing you the onset of symptoms. When someone is clinically diagnosed with Ebola, what we see as far as viral load, you know, how infected a person is with virus, how much virus is in the body, and you can't even see it on the graphic. It's so small. By day two, something very, very interesting happens as far as viral load levels. What happens, Sonia, within just 2 days of clinical infection? How much do virus levels jump?
Typically 1,000-fold in 2 days of clinic, after 2 days of clinical illness.
That's
and
right.
Then up to 10,000-fold when they reach their peak on the third to fifth day of symptoms.
So the point is, if you want to transmit Ebola infection, it's not going to happen very effectively before a person has been diagnosed. But the point is, there still is some virus there. And if we're going to be totally honest, we're not going to say there's zero risk. And because of this, it has provoked a lot of discussion in the medical community and in the public about whether Ebola can be transmitted through the air. Centers for Disease Control is trying to allay fears, but they're pretty honest on their website. Someone told me after I published this in the book, Evading Ebola, they said that the CDC had taken down some of this material off their website. I don't know whether that's true or not, but what did we find when we were doing the initial research on this topic? What did the Centers for Disease Control go on record as saying?
They said this, and I quote, "Airborne transmission of Ebola virus has been hypothesized, but not demonstrated, in humans. While Ebola virus can be spread through airborne particles under experimental conditions in animals, this type of spread has not been documented during human Ebola virus disease outbreaks in settings such as hospitals or households."
Okay, so how do you put that in plain English?
So they're saying that it's possible that the Ebola virus could be spread via airborne particles, such as with someone sneezing or coughing. And it has been shown to be that way in the spreading it from animal to animal. But it has not been documented in humans, so we don't know for sure, but they're saying it's still possible.
Yeah, and I think this is an accurate description of it. Now, you've got to think about this, and then we've got to look at the evidence, and we'll show you the evidence. How would you document it? How would you prove that someone got it from airborne transmission? Here's the big issue. Previous outbreak investigations have identified Ebola patients who had no known direct contact with other infected individuals. Because of that, many are saying, well, how did they get it? If they didn't have any known contact, one likely explanation is what?
That they got it from aerosolized virus particles.
That's right. They got it through the air. Now, there's other possibilities, too. They could have contacted what we call fomites. That's inanimate objects. They could have gotten it from an animal. This brings it to some other hot topics, Sonia. Dogs and Ebola. How about that one? I know you're a dog lover as well, and some dogs have taken the brunt from this, getting quarantined, one there in Europe even euthanized because of contact with Ebola.
Yes. Well, they've studied dogs in villages in Africa that had both human Ebola cases and documented infected animal carcasses. So they studied the dogs in these villages, and over 30% of pet dogs there showed blood evidence of past Ebola infection.
So it sounds like these dogs had inapparent infections.
That's what it appears to be.
And so they've got the virus, and I think there's legitimate concerns. Could dogs be carrying Ebola? What about this other scenario, Sonia, of fomites? What is a fomite, first of all?
A fomite is some inanimate object that can spread bacteria or viruses from one person to another. For example, a handkerchief or anything that someone handles who has the virus.
And what do we know about it? I mean, is there any evidence that you could get Ebola from some inanimate object, whether it's a seat or something else?
Well, in a previous Ebola outbreak, at least one case was traced to a blanket that had been used by an infected individual.
Okay, now in fairness, there's some other studies out there, too, that have looked at blankets and bedding, right?
Yes, and in those studies, they were unable to demonstrate viral contamination via these fomites.
Okay, so basically, if we were to summarize, there's probably a small risk of transmission from things like bedding and clothing used by people with clinical illness, but it's probably quite small, and because we don't have rampant Ebola in America right now, not real likely. But on the other hand, somebody, if they do have active Ebola infection and they're exposed to the public, they could contaminate surfaces, couldn't they?
It's still possible, yes. So it's better to just play it safe. Treat all surfaces as, you know, potentially contaminated.
Yeah, now, I mean, this may sound extreme, but the approach that I'm taking in my book, Evading Ebola, is, listen, Ebola is in the air, quote, in the air. I'm not saying it's aerosolized in your neck of the woods, but what I'm saying is Ebola is present in our world. We could become exposed. There's simple, prudent things we can do to prevent exposure. Just one other piece of information, because we got to set the stage for some key things you can do. Seven things we're going to give you in this show that can help you prevent developing clinical Ebola infection, even if you're exposed. We've got to go to Kikwit, Democratic Republic of Congo, 1995. They did a study there. After this outbreak, what did they find?
Yes, perhaps the most notable finding was this, and that was that nearly 10% of the villagers they examined, 15 out of 161, showed evidence of past Ebola infection. But the amazing thing was, none of these people had ever evidenced any clinical Ebola infection, none even had a family member who did. And furthermore, only a third, or 5 of those 15, even knew of a friend or acquaintance with Ebola.
The point is, they got it somewhere. Did they get it from the food, from the air, from fomites? Here's the point. Ebola's out there. We could become exposed, but you don't have to get sick with it. In our final segment, we pull this all together, drawing from my book, Evading Ebola, 7 practical things you can do to keep yourself from clinical Ebola infection. You don't want to miss it. I'm Dr. DeRose. We'll be right back.
Today's broadcast has been pre-recorded. However, if you have questions about today's show or would like further information, please call 1-800-775-HOPE. That's 1-800-775-4673. We'll be right back after this.
Navigating this world when you are undereducated can be difficult. I'm Dr. Ben Carson, and I know this for a fact. When I was growing up, my family lived in dire poverty, and because of my poor learning skills, my classmates called me dummy. My life began to turn around when my mother encouraged me to read. I went from the bottom of my class to graduating from Yale University and becoming the youngest director of pediatric neurosurgery at Johns Hopkins Hospital. I know how important it is to nurture a child's dream.
When I grow up, I want to become a scientist.
I want to be a doctor, just like Ben Carson.
I hope to become an engineer.
I want to be a teacher or maybe a broadcaster.
The Carson Scholars Fund is impacting schools across the nation by encouraging children to read, write, and excel at math and science so they can realize their dreams. We need your help. To learn more about the Carson Scholars Fund and to donate, visit our website at carsonscholars.org.
After all, the person who has the most to do with your success is you.
I'm in almost every school bus and classroom.
I go to school with your children.
We say the Pledge of Allegiance together.
You see me around the neighborhood and you tell me that I'm a pretty good kid.
Well, I'm one out of every five children in America and I'm struggling with hunger.
This problem is closer than you think. My teacher tells me we can grow up to be whatever we want.
I want to grow up to be someone who doesn't go to bed hungry.
There's enough food in this country to feed everybody.
Please visit feedingamerica.org today and find your local food bank for ways to help.
Every dollar you donate helps provide 8 meals for kids like me, quietly struggling with hunger.
Together, we are Feeding America, brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
You're listening to Dr. David DeRose on American Indian Living. Your comments and questions are welcome. Call now at 1-800-775-HOPE. 1-800-775-4673. Here again is Dr. DeRose.
We are in our final segment of American Indian Living today. We've been speaking about Ebola. It's based on my research on the topic. We've distilled it into a actually very short book, less than 90 pages, Evading Ebola. It's available on Amazon's Kindle. Should be on Amazon as a print book as this program is airing. We're encouraging you, if you've been listening to us in the first three segments, that in the context of the present outbreak in West Africa, we need to be living an Ebola-aware lifestyle. We need to be mindful that we could be exposed. And one of the things, Sonia, my wife who's here next to me, if you're just joining us, Dr. Sonia DeRose. Sonia, one of the things we've got to think about is what?
Hygiene.
Exactly.
Basic hygiene.
Exactly. You know, Sonia, a lot of people, when I mention hygiene, we often speak first about something that sounds pretty mundane. What is one of the cornerstones of hygiene in the medical community?
This goes back to when you were a little kid. Your mother was always telling you, wash your hands, right?
Yeah,
well,
many of them did.
Well, it's very important.
Very important stuff, hand washing. And a lot of people tell me, well, I know how to wash my hands. You don't need to tell me. But there's some common misconceptions about the importance of hand washing from a public health standpoint. Just give us really briefly why it's so important to wash our hands.
Well, many conditions like colds and the flu are spread by your contaminated hands touching your eyes or nose.
Now, of course, Ebola can also be transmitted this way, right?
That's right.
So if I've got the Ebola virus on my hands, rub my eyes, I can get the infection, right?
That's correct.
How is another common way that these infectious agents are transmitted?
Is by eating after using the restroom, not washing your hands properly, then eating or preparing food.
Okay, so you go in the restroom, someone else who had, let's say, Ebola infection, it's in their stool, they didn't wash carefully or whatever, or they did wash carefully, but they touched the handle, of course, of the sink, the faucet, turn the water on, and then you turn the water on, you can be exposed right there, especially if you turn the water off as well. I mean, we're getting ahead of ourselves because we're speaking about some of the common misconceptions when people wash their hands. But the point is, you can get Ebola by ingesting it, by eating it, as well as by inoculating or touching your mucous membranes. Sonia, give us the common problems that people have with washing their hands. How do you do it right?
Okay. Well, there are common hand-washing mistakes that people make, four of them. One, they wash for too short a time period. Number two, if you're turning the water faucet off with your clean washed hands. Three, assuming the paper towel dispenser lever is clean. And four, opening the bathroom door with your now washed hands. Those are all mistakes.
So they're mistakes because if you wash your hands, then they're clean. But if you turn off the faucet, you just touch something dirty.
You've just gotten dirty again.
So what do you do?
Well, very simple. Just turn the water faucet handle on with a paper towel, or at least when you're done washing, you do it. But wash your hands with soap and water for at least 20 seconds.
Okay.
Then use paper or some other means to get paper to use the lever, paper towel dispenser lever, so you're not getting your hands dirty by touching that. Dry your hands. Turn the faucet off with your paper towel, not your bare hands. And open the bathroom door with the paper towel as well.
Okay, now a lot of people say this sounds really burdensome, but it can make a huge difference, even with colds and flu. It's not just Ebola that's transmitted this way. Food poisoning, common way it's transmitted. Unhygienic practices in the bathroom from food handlers. They can wash their hands, but if they touch that bathroom door and someone was just in there who had some infectious disease, it is going to be in the food, make no mistake about it. Well, that's our first point, simple hygiene principles. We go into more detail in the book, but I think you get the picture. Focus on hygiene. What about diet? We got to give you six more things in our remaining time that can help you prevent Ebola. Let's put it this way, Sonia. We know in the medical community, if you are not at a good nutritional status, your immune system is not functioning up to par. In Africa, for example, speak about another virus, measles. If someone doesn't have enough vitamin A in their body, they will be more susceptible to measles. They'll tend to get measles in more severe form. If we give them vitamin A after contracting the virus, they will tend to do better. What do we know about vitamin A compounds in relation to Ebola? Some very interesting research, isn't there, with this compound retinazone. What do we know about it?
Yes, this agent has been shown to have powerful effects against viruses such as hepatitis C, HIV, and even Zaire-type Ebola.
Yeah, so this is exciting. And again, we're not recommending you go out to the drugstore and get a bunch of vitamin A. We just recommend you eat more fruits and vegetables. Beta-carotene is a safe form of vitamin A. You will not get toxic on it if you're eating it in food sources. If you take a beta-carotene supplement, you can get too much. That can hurt your immune system. But the bottom line on nutrition is the best foods for your immune system are whole plant foods, like the corn, the beans, the squash that have been held in high esteem throughout Indian country for decades, for centuries. Okay, hygiene. Diet, what's next? Practical things people can do to decrease their risk of Ebola infection.
Exercise is very important.
Exercise is huge, isn't it?
Yes.
If you want to have an immune system that is functioning up to par, you want to get moderate exercise on a daily basis. Daily, moderate exercise. Sonia, a lot of people think this way. Hey, if a little bit is good, more is better. Is that true when it comes to exercise?
Depends on how much more. Yes, moderate exercise is good, but over-exercise is actually immunosuppressive. It depresses your immune system.
Now, that's right. So if you're doing exhaustive exercise, this has been well studied. One study that I found especially fascinating, published in Exercise Immunology Review in 2010, researchers had elite cyclists, you know, very fit individuals, exercise vigorously for 2 hours. They measured their immune system after the exercise. Their natural killer cells, this is a type of white blood cell very important for fighting Ebola, was significantly depressed. It stayed low for 2 hours, 4 hours, 6 hours after exercise, all the way to 24 hours out. Their immune system had not recovered. Do not engage in over-exercise, this will suppress the immune system. So proper diet, moderate regular exercise, hygiene. What else is on our list for things that people can do to decrease the risk of Ebola?
Water. Water is very important. Keeping well hydrated, drinking enough water.
And of course, water stands in contradistinction to other beverages that can suppress immunity. What would be high on your list as far as a beverage that can cause your immune system to struggle?
Alcohol.
No, you're exactly right. The data is clear. Everyone agrees heavy alcohol consumption really causes the immune system to tank. Moderate alcohol consumption, a little bit more questionable, right?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, some of the research says it suppresses the immune system. Others says it doesn't. Here's my take on it. So you tell me if this makes sense to you. My take on it is this. Any amount of alcohol suppresses the immune system. Any amount. Okay? But here's the catch. Alcoholic beverages have what in them?
They have antioxidants.
That's right. They've got other phytochemicals, other good things. When you drink a beer, you're not just drinking alcohol. When you drink wine, it doesn't just have alcohol. So there are some good things in there, along with the alcohol that's bad for your immune system. There may be some things that help it, so it looks like it balances out. Well, I say, well, wait a minute. Why take anything that suppresses your immune system? If you want to get good things from grapes, what should you do?
Just eat the grapes or even drink grape juice.
Simple solution. That's my recommendation. We're talking about living an Ebola-aware lifestyle. We're telling you, get plenty of moderate exercise, proper diet, hygiene, water is the best beverage. What else do we need to keep in perspective?
Sunshine. The sun is actually very beneficial for our immune systems.
And we think that has to do with what?
Vitamin D production is one of the big issues.
You're exactly right on. Sunshine
is good.
We just
heard a dermatologist the other day say that the sun prevents 50 to 100 times more cancers than it causes.
Now, that's amazing because it does have this beneficial immune effect through vitamin D. Sonia, our time has just about slipped away, but this one our listeners can practice, even if we're not talking about it. It's a simple one. What is it?
Getting plenty of sleep.
That's right. Research on viral illness has shown that people who cut themselves short on sleep dramatically increase their risk of viral infection. This was shown with the rhinovirus, the cause of the common cold. Well, we have time to mention the two others, not in much detail. If you're a cigarette smoker, we're not talking about ceremonial use of tobacco necessarily. That's another question you can look into. But cigarette smoking depresses the immune system, and something that can help your immune system is social support. Stay connected with your family, your tribe, your community. We got to run. This show, entitled Evading Ebola, it's the same as my book, available on Amazon, Kindle, and also in print edition. Hopefully today's show has given you some hope. There can be inapparent infection. If you're exposed to Ebola, you can fight it off. We've tried to give you some things you can do to make the difference between health and disease, especially in this time of crisis. For all of us at American Indian Living, I'm Dr. David DeRose, wishing you the very best of health.
This is Life Talk Radio.